From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Greener, a weekly talk show about the environment and our relationship with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. Well, we'll give you a brief break on all the coronavirus and COVID talk this morning, at least for an hour. Or probably, you know what? Forget that.
Who part of an hour. Let's not overpromise.
At some point. But first, we'll speak with Doug Tallamy. He's a professor in the entomology department at the University of Delaware about his new book, Nature's Best Hope, a new approach to conservation that starts in your yard.
In his book, Professor Tallamy outlines his vision for a grassroots, homegrown approach to conservation. Nature's Best Hope advocates for homeowners to turn their yards into conservation corridors, a system of backyard national parks. With 83% of the contiguous U.S. being privately owned, there's a great need and a great opportunity to create vital habitat in our own yards and spaces, and Professor Tallamy has the research to back it up. All right, Professor Tallamy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, pleasure to be here.
So why don't you start by telling us a little bit more about what it is that you do at the university and how you kind of got started in this field of research?
Oh, boy. Well, I am an entomologist in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology. This is my 40th year.
So congratulations.
For a while. Yeah, still around. I got interested in insects when I took the course in entomology in college. Wow. Before that, I was collecting turtles and snakes. I've always been interested in nature. But I got into the current line of research about 12 years ago when I realized that we have replaced a good deal of our native plant communities with plants from someplace else. Typically, we landscape our yards with ornamental plants, often from Asia. Many of those have escaped and become serious invasive species in our natural areas. And now about a third of the vegetation in our natural areas are plants from someplace else. And this matters because, and can you hear me?
Yes. We can, yeah.
Yes, go ahead.
Okay, this matters because plants from other continents are not, our insects are not adapted to eating them. And that means that the food web that is supported by insects is seriously disrupted, which impacts birds and most everything else. So once we made that connection, we started doing the research that actually quantified this, get the numbers. And my goal really has been to convince the public, the people who own the private land in the U.S., that they have an important role in conservation. All they have to do is exercise proper plant choice, and we can really improve our conservation value of all those public lands.
So talk a little bit about then, what would you say is the biggest invasive species that we have in our yards today?
Oh, well, you know, that depends on where you are.
Right.
Where I am here, I'm in Southeast Pennsylvania. We have a number of them. Porcelain berry is a huge one that has reared its head recently. We've got a ground cover called Japanese stilt grass, which just blots out everything else. Autumn olive, buckthorn, multiflora rose, Bradford pear or calorie pear is a huge one that has escaped. You know, as you move further west and get into the drier areas, you have different invasive species. Cheatgrass in the west is a huge one.
Right.
And it's responsible for an awful lot of the forest fires that we encounter. It depends on where you are. But there are about 3,300 species of plants that we consider to be invasive.
Wow. Well, obviously, a big one out here, too, and I'm sure back there, is Kentucky bluegrass, or that type of lawn-based grass, I'll call it.
Right. It's true. We plant it everywhere, and it has escaped and is in an awful lot of places. I tend to think of the big woody plants as being the most serious problems because they actually block out so many of our other native plants. Whereas grass, you know, things will grow up through it and actually can be replaced by natives over time if it's not constantly mowed. So I wouldn't rank Kentucky bluegrass is one of our major problems.
Oh, interesting.
So tell us about, while we're on the topic of Kentucky bluegrass, tell us a little bit about the extent to which we use this species in landscaping in our country. I know you shared some impressive statistics in your book.
Yeah, you're talking about the lawn. Yeah. We have a love affair with the lawn. It's one of our major status symbols. If you have a big lawn, you're a good citizen, you're wealthy, all the things that we all want to be and we want the public to know about. So that has been our major landscaping paradigm for the last century at least. And that has resulted in an area of lawn greater than the size of New England right now. It's over 40 million acres of lawn.
Wow.
And we keep increasing that by a couple hundred square miles every year. So, you know, if lawn was a functional ecosystem, that would be okay. But I always talk about four things that every landscape should do. It has to support complex communities of pollinators, because we need pollinators everywhere, not just in our crops. It has to support food webs, because we need other animals everywhere. That's what runs our ecosystems. Has to sequester carbon, and it has to manage our watersheds. And lawn is terrible at each one of those things.
Hmm.
So every place we have lawn, we've created an ecological dead zone. And that's the problem. So I suggest we cut the area of lawn in half. We take that 40 million acres, everybody cuts their lawn in half and plants it with the plants that are really important in running our ecosystems. We could create a new national park that would be 20 million acres in size. And if you add up the major national parks in the lower 48 states, that's bigger than all of them combined. So that's what I talk about, homegrown national park. We're going to do this at home. We're going to do it in our corporate landscapes, wherever we work and play. Not so much in our agriculture. We can leave that alone for now. But that will create the connectivity between the designated natural areas that we have out there, which at this point are too small and too isolated to actually maintain the species that run our ecosystems.
So tell us a little bit about why lawn, you know, doesn't support the complex, you know, community of pollinators, and why it doesn't support that food web. Give us, you know, an idea of those details of the processes that we use to maintain our lawn that kind of prevent some of these other functions.
Well, part of the status symbol today is that your lawn has to be perfect, which means no, quote, weeds. So no clover, no dandelions, nothing that actually blooms. So when you put fertilizer on your lawn, you're typically included in the fertilizer. You don't even know it most of the time, is a broadleaf herbicide that will kill any of the non-grass plants that are there. And, you know, grass is not a flowering plant in the way that would support pollinators. So right away, you have no forage for those pollinators. When you put herbicides and insecticides on your lawn, you kill them. We have about 4,000 species of native bees in the U.S. and one species of introduced honeybee. So the major pollination that has always occurred in North America comes from those native bees. And the reason I say they're important everywhere, not just in agriculture, is because they're pollinating 80% of all plants and 90% of all flowering plants. So if we lost our pollinators, we'd lose 80 to 90% of the plants on the planet. And that simply is not an option unless we want to disappear as well.
So this
urge to support pollinators, everybody talks about, well, because they pollinate our crops. Yeah, they do. But that's actually a fairly minor reason compared to keeping the plants around that run the world.
Hmm.
So we can kind of start to draw the line between this lack of biodiversity and lack of flowering plants in our, you know, man-made landscapes to some of the headlines that we've been seeing lately in the science community, you know, loss of our insect populations, loss of, oh my gosh, I don't know, what was it, 3 billion birds.
Yeah.
Something in that neighborhood. I may be mistaken on the number there, but there are some pretty shocking numbers that have been coming out. And maybe it's not just, you know, some of the other barriers we've been talking about for these species.
No, it is. It is a loss of 3 billion birds in the last 40 years, just in North America. And I like to remind people how many birds that actually is. A million seconds is 12 days. No, a billion seconds is 12 days.
Mm.
Oh, boy, I'm messing up my statistics. A million seconds is 12 days. A billion seconds is 31.7 years.
Wow.
Wow.
I got that straight. So a billion is a huge number, is all I'm trying to say.
Right.
And we've lost about a third of the North American bird population. And there are a number of reasons for that. Everybody says loss of habitat. But, you know, habitat is a place to live and something to eat. So when you decrease the insect communities in our natural areas and in our man-made areas, then the birds have nothing to eat. And 96% of our terrestrial birds are rearing their young on insects. It's not a trivial connection there. You're not going to have birds without insects.
Okay. And so that's why birds are important. They play a critical link in ecosystem health. And if I was, if I was a bee or a butterfly, I consider lawns as flyover country. Just fly right over.
Because I need to
keep going because there's something better over here. We had an interview a couple months ago with a scientist from Minnesota State Department of Environmental Protection or so. They were doing a study that looked at the importance of clover as a way of replacing your, say, Kentucky bluegrass or that type of grass with clover that could also be mowed because it grows and it flowers very low to the ground. Your thoughts on that? Is that good?
Well, that's the way it used to be in the 50s.
Okay.
You're probably too young, but my very first bee sting was running through my front yard with my bare feet, and I stepped on a honeybee that was on clover.
Yeah.
It used to be an important part of all of our lawns. And, of course, clover is a legume, so it adds nitrogen to the soil, which means you don't have to fertilize.
Right.
And it does bloom. It's a good flowering plant for at least many of our generalist bees. The problem with that is that we have to service not just our generalist bees, but also the specialist bees, bees that require pollen of particular plants. So, for example, where I live, there are 13 species of native bees that will only reproduce on the pollen of goldenrod. Mm. If I don't have goldenrod in my yard, I've just lost 13 species of bees. There are 12 more species that only reproduce on the pollen of native willows. If I don't have willows, I've lost another 12. And right down the line, sunflowers are really important. Evening primrose, violets, all of these things are servicing particular species of bees. So it's true, you can put clover in your yard and that's a good idea. And you will provide pollen and nectar for particular species of bumblebees and the honeybee. But you're going to miss all of those native bees that we really need to take care of. So we want to be a little bit more diverse than simply adding clover.
So let's talk about what an ideal yard scape, front yard, backyard would look like.
Okay, again, that depends on where you live.
Sure.
You have to pay attention to the biome you're in, the amount of rain you get, your altitude. And if you look at the natural areas around you, then you have to look with a critical eye, make sure you're not looking at a bunch of invasive species from China. Mm-hmm. It'll give you a good idea of the plants that ought to be featured in our built landscapes. So in 84% of the counties in North America, oaks are the number one plant in terms of supporting the caterpillars that run our food webs. So that's not true everywhere, but it's true in an awful lot of places. Mm. Where I live, there are 557 species of caterpillars that eat oaks.
Wow.
Compared to some other native plants like tulip trees, only 21 eat those. Or non-native plants like ginkgo, zero. Eat those.
Hmm.
So there are huge differences in the ability of different plants to support our food webs. And what you want to do, I call those top producers keystone plants. Hmm. You want to identify what they are for where you are and make sure that you have some representative of those keystone plants in your landscape. And then you can diversify around those. You might say, well, how do I know what those are? You go to the National Wildlife Federation website and look up Native Plant Finder. Put in your zip code and the ranked list of woody and herbaceous plants that are best at supporting your food web in your county will pop up.
One question that I have for you along finding native plants is the role of cultivars. So sometimes at our local nurseries or plant centers, you'll see cultivars of native species that have been, you know, selected for certain traits and those kinds of things. Do those fill the same role as, like, you know, the oak that you'd find in the woods behind your house?
That's an excellent question. It's actually one of the most frequent questions I get. the answer is, it depends.
Okay.
So a cultivar of a native plant is just a genetic variant of that particular plant species. And it's been either actively selected or simply taken out of the wild with a trait that people like. You know, unfortunately, we've come to see plants just as decoration. So we're always looking for traits that are pretty.
Right.
Maybe it's, you know, it's got variegated leaves or reddish leaves or, you know, the traits that we favor.
Sure.
Well, then it's propagated clonally and sold in a nursery. Somebody puts a name on it. Excuse me, I'm going to cough here. Excuse me.
Okay. Kept our distance.
So that's it. That's a cultivar. Is that as good as the straight species? Well, we did a study. We looked at six very common cultivar traits. And compared insect use of the cultivars with the straight species in a common garden experiment. And somewhat to our surprise, we found that only one trait consistently reduced insect use, and that was taking green leaves and making them red or purple.
Oh.
And that makes sense because you're adding anthocyanins to those leaves. Hmm. And anthocyanins are feeding deterrents. But taking a tall plant and making it short, or introducing disease resistance, or enhancing fall color, or making a berry a little bit bigger, none of those actually decrease insect use of the plant itself. Now, some of those common cultivars are those that are, you know, impact flowers. They change something about the flower color or the flower size. And that's a different story because more often than not, those types of cultivars do decrease the use of pollinators on those plants. Not always. That's why you can't make a blanket statement. But and we didn't look at that. A woman named Annie White in the University of Vermont has been looking at that. More and more people are starting studies. I would say it's always safest to go with the straight species. So if you go to your nursery and all they have are cultivars, ask for the straight species. And if they say, well, we don't carry that, walk away.
Wow.
And if everybody does that, they'll start carrying it. It's just simply a matter of not believing that there's a market for those straight species.
Right.
If we convince them that there is, they'll be carried.
We're speaking with Douglas Talamy. Douglas is a professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware. And we're talking about his new book, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to Conservation That Starts in Your Yard. So I'm all in, okay? But here's my challenge. And here's probably some challenges you face. I live in a condominium complex, townhomes, and we have acres of grass. Because our HOA and property managers have said our visitors, our homeowners, our seasonal visitors, they love the grass because they like the way it looks and it's manicured and it's neat and they can run around it and their dogs can poop and pee in it and all that. That's one of the challenges we, who have tried to compel them to think otherwise, face. You know, do you see similar pushback from homeowners?
Oh, sure. That's a common challenge across the country. But, you know, the HOAs, the homeowners associations, are made up of people. We are people.
Mm-hmm.
And we can, I was talking about infiltrating them. It's a matter of getting people to understand that every inch of the earth is part of a functioning ecosystem. And we can landscape in a way that degrades that or in a way that enhances it. And with the current numbers of people we have on this planet, we've got to enhance it everywhere. We've degraded it far more than we can stand. And that counts for condominiums as well, with huge, huge lawns. So once people understand the consequences of those lawns, all the negative things that they're doing to the surrounding environment, they're you know, they can loosen up a little bit. I'm not talking about having unmanicured lawn. I'm talking about having a less lawn. But the lawn you have will be manicured. You can still walk on it. I know how many people are running around the lawn. Very few. Those are big, blank, empty spaces most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about taking away football stadiums or something. I'm talking about, you know, using lawn as what Thomas Rainer calls wall-to-wall carpeting instead of an area rug. We've got to go with the area rug approach. And it is pretty. We will be high class. We'll be manicured. But there are going to be other plants out there as well that are also attractive. It's you know, not like a giant green blank lawn is the most attractive thing in the world. It really isn't. So I say get in, you know, join your HOA, change the rules. Those rules largely were initiated in the 70s when we were just trying to get people to stop having rusty cars in their front yard.
Right.
And then we went crazy with all these rules that were really focused around status. So we need to change our status symbols. We need to have the small lawn with a lot of plants be the new status symbol. And, you know, in areas of the country where water is a challenge, that's happening simply from water conservation perspective. The big green lawn, it takes water that we don't have. So the guy with the green lawn is no longer the high-class citizen. He's the social pariah.
Hmm.
And that's happened pretty quickly. So we need to expand that to its impact on biodiversity as well.
One other impact of the green lawns, the Kentucky bluegrass that you mentioned briefly, was that they do a really poor job of like carbon storage, carbon sequestration. And I bring that up because I think it might be interesting to our community who's really focused on carbon right now and getting to net zero. So talk to us a little bit about the impacts of grass versus, you know, having a wider array of plants and trees and woody shrubs.
You know, our typical turf grasses have very short root systems. All plants sequester carbon and pump it into the ground, but the shorter, the smaller the root system, the less carbon is actually sequestered. So when you compare lawns to almost any other type of planting, it comes out on the short end of the stick. It sequesters very little carbon. So what we want to do is get the deep-rooted plants. That includes any of our prairie plants. It includes our trees and shrubs. Get a lot more of those back into the landscape. They will pull carbon out of the atmosphere. They build their bodies out of it. But even more important, they're pumping carbon into the soil day in, day night, day out. The soil scientists are now telling us that our soils can sequester 7 times the amount of carbon that's in the atmosphere right now. It's just a matter of getting it out of the atmosphere and putting it into the soil. And of course, every time we disturb the soil, every time we turn it over, it releases carbon again. So we need to get it into stable soils that are not going to be disturbed. And the way to do that is plants. It's plants that do that. And lawn is our worst choice in terms of doing that.
Hmm. You know, one other thing I was thinking about in the few minutes we have remaining is the landscaping industry, too. You know, we talk about, like you're saying, we have to convince our HOAs and other our neighbors to change their behavior here, but we also have to change the landscaping industry because they, let's be honest, they make a lot of money growing and fertilizing and pesticiding and cutting and trimming grass, and so there's some changes in behaviors there too that are necessary.
Well, they make a lot of money doing that because we hire them to do that.
Yes,
we have to remember we're not working for the landscaping industry; they're working for us. So we're the boss. We get to hire them for what we want them to do. What I would like to see is a new industry created. We'll call it ecological landscaping. Mm. So we're not talking about losing jobs here. We're talking about changing the way we treat the landscape. That's going to take labor. It's going to take knowledge. And rather than hire your lawn guys who just, you know, mow, blow, and go, you're going to hire an ecological landscaper who will put these plants in your yard. We'll, you know, manicure the lawn that is there, but we'll reduce it and then manage it. These lawns, you know, this type of landscaping is not carefree. It needs to be managed. You need to keep those invasive species out.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that is can be labor intensive, particularly when you're in creating it. So those are the, you know, that's the industry that needs to be doing that. I love how the horticulture industry and the grass industry call themselves the green industry.
Right.
I want to really make them the green industry by incorporating ecologically sound practices into the way we treat our landscapes.
So I want to ask a question about scale with this. You know, if you don't have any yard that you have a control over, or you're like Chris and you have a patio, you know, out in the back, and that's about all you have control over. What about potted plants or planters? Do you recommend things like this, you know, make a difference even on a small scale like that?
Absolutely. They could make particularly, you know, if you're the only person in the world that does this, it's not going to work. But if everybody in cities had potted plants and maybe even green roofs or plants that are they're carefully selected to service the pollinators we were talking about, it would make a huge difference. There's a strip of plants on an elevated railroad site in Manhattan called the High Line, which has become a tourist destination. Millions of people go to the High Line every year to see this little strip of plants. It's a little bit of nature right in the middle of Manhattan. And you'd be surprised the number of insects and birds and butterflies and things that are actually using those plants right there in the center of Manhattan. So it's very impressive to see how these creatures actually find these plants. But I am convinced if we put plants right in the heart of our cities or anywhere else, they will be used. And the more plants we put into these centers, the greater the impact it's going to be. But of course, it does require a combined effect. That's why everybody who lives on planet Earth has a stewardship role. Now, if you live in a city, you don't own any property at all, your local park is probably begging for volunteers. They're all understaffed. They're all underfunded. So we do have an awful lot of people. 82% of our country lives in cities now, but that doesn't mean they don't have a stewardship role and they can't play a positive role in conservation. And of course, if you do own a piece of the earth, you're responsible for being a steward of the life that is on that property. And as far as we know, it could be all the life in the universe. So it's a really important role that you're now, I hope you're going to adopt.
Well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to fill my back deck with potted plants, etc. And I'm going to declare it the Christopher Cherniak State Park. I don't want to be so self-absorbed as to call it a national park. I'll start with State Park. And here's the reason, here's a benefit to this. Since I'm now completely cut myself off from human contact, and I spend 22 hours out of the day at home inside, I'm going to need these plants and their insects and their birds as my new buddies. As my new psychological relief.
You can maintain your sanity.
Yes. So there is our connection. I knew we would find a connection to the virus somehow.
Interacting with nature right at home, there's a number of really important benefits there, not just avoiding coronavirus, but there are measurable medical benefits to spending a little quiet time in a natural area. And it doesn't have to be a real national park. It can be your yard. So we need to do more of that.
Yes.
Well, one last question before we let you off the hook. You shared some great stats about, you know, the number of pollinators that use different plants. You shared with us the National Wildlife Federation website is a good source. But where are some good information sources that people can go to if they want to get moving on this in their own yards?
Well, you mentioned my book, Nature's Best Hope. That's a lot of information in there. It's out in February. You can get it on Amazon. And that's why I write these books. They're not, you know, they're not written for the scientific community. They're written for the general public. So I selfishly say that is your best source.
Well, I would agree. And I would jump in and say that it is genuinely such an easy and fun and informative read.
And beautifully illustrate so many wonderful photos.
Yeah.
Nice. Call them beautiful color photos.
I have wonderful subjects out there.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Shortage of that. Douglas Talamy, professor in the Department of Entomology and Wildlife Ecology at the University of Delaware, the author of the new book, Nature's Best Hope, A New Approach to conservation that starts in your yard. Thank you so much for taking extra time to talk to us this morning on This Green Earth, Doug, and we hope to stay in touch.
Well, you're quite welcome.